This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charmaine Cozier. On The Inquiry this week, we're looking at unregulated wines and spirits, including fake alcohol. What makes them toxic and how widespread are they? The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines to explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world. Search for The Inquiry wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour with me, Nuala McGovern, in Washington, D.C. Tim Franks is in London. It is a freezing, beautiful, clear morning in this city where in just a few hours' time, Donald Trump will become the 47th president of the United States. The events of the day, as you will have heard, are now indoors in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building, that iconic dome that is a landmark of Washington politics and home to the U.S. Congress and Senate. The temperature of -4 Celsius, that's approximately 24 degrees Fahrenheit, means that well-wishers won't see President-elect Trump in the traditional format on the steps of the Capitol. But despite the weather and that disappointment, you can't miss the warmth and jubilation on every corner from supporters of Mr. Trump, who they have come in the hundreds of thousands to make their way to D.C. to celebrate his victory and inauguration. President-elect Trump is about to begin what some thought would be out of reach. That is his second non-consecutive term as president of the United States. Let us begin by turning to some of our correspondents that are out in D.C. this morning. Let me begin with Neda Taufik, BBC North America correspondent at Capitol Hill. Welcome to the program, Neda. What is happening where you are?
Well, we are here in the Capitol, indoors, as you say. First time in 150 years that this has happened. We are so used to seeing the inauguration in person live. But I can tell you that here everyone is broadcasting. You have surrogates of Donald Trump coming out to speak ahead of the day's events, to, as well as he has, boast about his victory, to hype up what is to come, to say that there is a new era for Americans. So a lot of excitement among Donald Trump's supporters and surrogates here on Capitol Hill. Of course, meanwhile, across Washington, it has felt very different to his first inauguration in 2017. While the National Mall is closed, people have been told to go to the Capitol One Hill Arena or to find another bar to go to. You do see, as you say, the jubilation from his supporters, who say they would have been happy to stay out in the cold weather if it meant a chance to see the inauguration outside. But nevertheless, they are excited. They are energized. And there is really very little protest, a fraction of what we saw in 2017. As we really speak to those who oppose Donald Trump, who share that they are, rather than rising up, deciding to reflect on this day.
It's really quite something, isn't it? I guess it was Ronald Reagan in 1985, which Mr. Trump often compares himself to, that last hooded indoors. But I'm wondering, is Mr. Trump disappointed, do you think? It can't hold that many in the rotunda, right, to kind of give that sense of occasion. And we all know that Mr. Trump loves a huge rally.
That's right. And I think that's why he did his large rally last night, right? It was very much his kind of signature venue. It's where he feels the most comfortable. It's where he feels he's able to kind of speak from the hip directly to his supporters, because he's often made comments throughout these last few months after his impressive political comeback that this victory is down to his supporters. And he has really been trying to show that to these last few days. So that rally was really a chance for him to fire up his supporters before the big day today. We know he loves crowd sizes. In 2017, obviously, there was that controversy where he tried to claim that there were more of his supporters on the National Mall than Barack Obama's inauguration, which was not true. Perhaps the cold weather, even though he does like the big spectacle, he did say that the temperatures were dangerous. So instead, the Capital One Arena will be filled up again with his supporters.
Yes.
He'll head there after the Capitol.
You know, I noticed it this morning, 6 o'clock on the Metro. People were getting off at the Metro Center stop, which is one closest to the Capitol One, as opposed to the U.S. Capitol building, in their droves. Netta, thank you so much. We'll be speaking to you a little bit later. I want to bring in my colleague, BBC correspondent Caroline Hawley, who's surrounded by Donald Trump supporters. Would that be right, Caroline?
That is exactly right. So I'm outside the arena where yesterday Donald Trump gave his victory rally. And now people are queuing in large numbers. I mean, the queue is maybe 20 people deep, and it goes as far as you can see, snaking round blocks, people wearing Make America Great Again hats. And I've been speaking to people, obviously they're diehard supporters, people who would not be put off by the extreme cold. They are ardent in their enthusiasm, and they are saying that the main issues for them are border security and the economy. I spoke to one 23-year-old man who said, "I like everything about Donald Trump except for his spray tan." So just to kind of set the scene a bit here as well, we're outside a public library which has in its window a Black Lives Matter poster and rainbow flags, sign of the other America, because this, of course, is a deeply divided country. As you know, Donald Trump's supporters are demoralized and many of them afraid. But the people I'm with are all fervent in their support for him. They say he will make America great again, just as he promised.
Caroline Hawley, thank you so much. We'll be also speaking to you and some of the people, of course, that are braving that cold, hoping to make it into the Capital One Center. I mentioned 200,000 is the expected figure that are making their way to D.C. The Capital One Center holds about 10% of that, about 20,000. So you can imagine the dichotomy that there is about those wanting to get in and those that will not. Now, it's not Donald Trump's first inauguration. Neither is it mine. I was here 8 years ago. Maybe you remember his inauguration speech from 2017. He painted a worrying state of life in America. My next guest was with me at that time as well. Let me play a little clip of that speech and then I'll speak to him.
Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation. An education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
I am joined by John Gizzi, chief political columnist and White House correspondent of the Trump-leaning media channel Newsmax. We are reunited after 8 years. John, great to have you back with me. At that point, I remember us afterwards being surprised by American carnage, as was the theme. We're hearing some lines coming through of what's expected in the inaugural address today. What about that term that I've heard so far, that he is expecting a revolution of common sense?
Well, certainly that's going to be the theme of the Trump inauguration, not unlike New Frontier being John Kennedy's theme. That is what people will take away from the inauguration, not the size of the crowds or even the cold weather. But as you say, Nuala, we agreed, and just about everyone agreed, that when we covered his inaugural address before, it was very dark and negative. American carnage is not upbeat.
It is not.
But this time, I think Mr. Trump has learned his lesson. Being out of office and then having to make a comeback, defying all odds, mellows one and makes one a little bit more thoughtful. And I think we'll see this in Donald Trump.
It's so interesting that you say that. Definitely many say he's coming back more confident than ever. But surely his campaign message was fight, fight, fight. It was, you know, to take the fight to the enemy within, which doesn't really give an idea of an optimistic or hopeful tone.
Well, I disagree with you with respect. Fight, fight, fight means stand up against the odds. And remember when that slogan became emblematic of the Trump campaign was when he avoided death by a millisecond. I mean, it was a true-to-life version of Day of the Jackal. And he came out surviving by a millisecond an assassin's bullet and said, fight, fight, fight. And that electrified his supporters.
So do you feel he will be a different president this time? You will agree that he has been divisive as a figure, as a candidate, and as a president previously. Can he actually be a president for all Americans?
Political scientists say that a candidate divides the public, but then a president unites them and brings them together. And as one who's covered presidential campaigns for, well, let's say decades, I have to say that I think Donald Trump has learned a lot from this campaign. Remember something. It's poignant that he's sworn in on the 91st birthday of Tom Baker, perhaps the most beloved of Doctor Who's. Donald Trump, like the 15 doctors, and I hope I got that number right, has had a regeneration. Only he's coming back as himself, but probably a very different person. More mellow, more thoughtful, and someone who's been given a second chance that few politicians could match.
Did you hear anything? I watched his rally last night, which also took place in the Capital One Arena, just to let people know around the world. That's in the Chinatown area of Washington, D.C. It's usually for, you know, be it sporting events or conventions. That's really the hot spot for Trump supporters over this long weekend. Did you hear anything last night that you felt he was signaling to Democrats, for example, that he would work with them or represent them?
Well, again, if you want me to be specific, a yes or no answer, no, I didn't. But we see different signs. Remember, just as President Franklin Roosevelt put two Republicans in his cabinet in 1933, Donald Trump has named Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Tulsi Gabbard, a former Democratic member of Congress from Hawaii, as Director of National Intelligence. That certainly is a step toward the other side of the aisle.
John Gizzi, always great to have you on the program. Thank you so much. Do stay warm today. Where are you heading?
I am heading to Newsmax's inaugural station downtown in Washington.
Okay, take it easy. And you are, of course, with us here in Washington, D.C. The flags are flying just outside the door. There is a cold breeze, but instead a bright and blue sky overhead. As I look out the window, the people that pass by, many of them wearing, I can see, red bobble hats, which are Trump, that is emblazoned across the front, some with the number 45. They might want to change that number to 47 as Donald Trump manages to pull off what many thought he would never do and have his second non-consecutive term as the United States president.
And coming up on the programme, we will be hearing from somebody who's going to be involved in that inauguration ceremony, the tenor, Christopher Macchio.
Rather than being nervous per se, I just feel imbued with a sense of responsibility to deliver a performance that really honors our great nation, but also uses the universality of music to really try and unite the nation going forward for the next 4 years.
More from the man who's going to be singing the national anthem in about 30 minutes. Our headlines this hour. The UN's head of humanitarian affairs says there's a staggering need in Gaza as most returning Palestinians find that their homes have been destroyed. More on that in just a moment. And hours before leaving office, Joe Biden has issued sweeping preemptive pardons to many people he says are at risk of politically motivated prosecutions. This is NewsHour. It's coming to you live from London and also from Washington. And we'll be back with Nuala in Washington for more on this momentous day shortly. But you're listening to me, Tim Franks, here in London. And it is also a big day in the Middle East because it's day two of the Gaza ceasefire after more than a year of war. A day for many of relief and of returns, as some of the hundreds of thousands of displaced Gazans picking their way back to their devastated neighbourhoods, of Palestinian prisoners being freed by Israel and, in Israel, of a great release of emotion as three young women hostages have returned to their families. Among them, the 28-year-old British Israeli national, Emily Damari. The sound of Emily Damari reuniting with her mother and other close relatives at a hospital near Tel Aviv. Tony Moss, Emily's cousin, spoke to the BBC's Lucy Manning in London last night.
We're just overjoyed, lost for words. Can't quite believe it. Didn't think it was going to happen and that she'd be first out. We just can't quite believe it. We're all so sad. This is just the beginning. We need to get the other hostages out.
One of the others to be released was 24-year-old Romy Gonen, who last night put out this brief voice message.
Thank you to everybody. I saw only a bit of the amazing things people did for me. I send everyone hugs and kisses and hope we meet soon.
Hours after the release of those three Israeli hostages, 90 Palestinian prisoners, women and teenage boys, were freed from Israeli jails, 30 prisoners for each hostage. Our correspondent John Donison watched that detainee release take place in the West Bank.
In the town square in Betunia, a mile from Offa prison, hundreds of Palestinians waited in the cold well past midnight. Some were there for as long as 10 hours. Waving Palestinian flags, launching fireworks, and at times chanting pro-Hamas songs, there was an atmosphere of excitement and nervous anticipation. Among them was Diash Dara, waiting for her sister Hadil. The 32-year-old university admin worker had been detained without charge in Israel for 7 months.
How do you feel today?
I'm happy, I think. Confused a little bit because of what happened in Gaza, of course. The most important thing that they stopped the war in Gaza. Even if she wasn't released today, we're okay with it. But at least the war has been ended.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, the buses carrying around 90 prisoners finally arrived, and the detainees fell into the arms of their loved ones. Among them was 62-year-old Khalida Jarrah, a politician from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, jailed after the October the 7th Hamas attack. She said it was a bittersweet moment.
Hard feelings. Firstly, the feeling of the freedom, and we thank everybody for this freedom. And on the other side, the pain for the loss of big numbers of martyrs. This is a double feeling that we live in. Situation in the prison is very difficult, and we wish freedom for the male and female prisoners.
Nearly all of those released were women, jailed for relatively minor offences. They included Hadia Shatara,
Today, the basic necessities of life in prison are almost non-existent. Today, prisoners, both male and female, are suffering from complete deprivation of basic rights, such as food, cleaning supplies, and essential items. Prisoners do not have adequate clothing. The situation in prison is chaotic, and there is a need to focus on the conditions inside the prison and the suffering of the prisoners.
And there will be more anxious waits like last night over the coming weeks. Around 1,900 prisoners are due to be freed in the first phase of the deal in exchange for 30 more Israeli hostages, on top of the three released already.
And that was John Donaldson reporting from Beitounia in the West Bank. Let's turn our attention from there to Gaza, that narrow strip of territory where, as our Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf was reporting today, people he was speaking to were talking of their first decent night's sleep in more than a year. But there's also, of course, immense destruction to overcome and immense deprivation. Under the terms of the ceasefire deal, there is due to be a surge in supplies of aid to the enclave, hundreds of trucks every day. Gisha is an Israeli advocacy group which has taken the Israeli government to court over the lack of aid going into Gaza. Its executive director is Tania Hari. What difference is she seeing?
Yesterday we saw more than 630 trucks enter the strip from two northern crossings and one southern crossing with Israel. They were bringing in shelter items, food, fuel, cooking gas, medical supplies. It's an amount of goods that we have not seen since the start of the war.
And is the reason that that many more trucks are going in simply that it is quiet now?
We don't doubt that the absence of hostilities is a factor here, but I would say the most important factor is political will. We also saw yesterday, for example, that the police inside of Gaza were allowed to take up their posts and prevent the kind of looting that we've seen in the last months that has really been one of the main factors in preventing aid from coming in safely. Requests for aid to come in have been fast-tracked by the Israeli government. And so I really think that we can't overlook the importance of political will in scaling up this aid response, which is so badly needed.
That completely contradicts, though, what the Israeli government has said up to now. And I've heard it time and again from ministers, from Israeli officials, when I've spoken to them, they have said there are no limits to the amount of aid that goes in. And it's all about capacity to distribute the aid inside Gaza.
Yes, that's unfortunately been a refrain that we have heard for many, many months, and it's simply not true. There are so many steps that could have been taken at any moment, and we're seeing those steps taken now in a matter of hours. For example, the two northern crossing points, this is the first time that they've both been opened simultaneously. That was a request that humanitarian agencies were making for months. We're seeing that requests to get humanitarian actors into the Gaza Strip are happening more quickly. At any given moment, so many things could have been put into place that would have allowed for a scaling up of the aid response that we're just starting to see now. And there's really something very tragic about that, that the civilian population in Gaza has gotten to a place of vast malnutrition, probably pockets of famine, people dying of disease and infections that could have been prevented with the entrance of medical supplies. It's really simply not true that the aid response was all it could have been.
How far could the response be complicated by the fact that the Israeli government appears committed to the idea of stopping the main UN relief agency, UNRWA, from operating from within Israel within the next couple of weeks?
Israel must allow all humanitarian actors to operate freely. That includes UNRWA. It includes a lot of other agencies. Israel is the occupying power. It is its responsibility to care for the welfare of the civilian population. At the very least, it must allow other organizations to step in and provide those services.
Tania Hari, executive director of the Israeli advocacy and legal support group Gisha. We have a live page on the second day of the ceasefire up and running on our website, bbc.com/news, and loads more from this edition of NewsHour with Nuala McGovern, particularly in Washington. Do stay with us.
Welcome back to Washington, D.C. I'm Nuala McGovern. In this city that is about to inaugurate the 47th president of the United States, Donald Trump, Tim Franks is in London. I want to turn to Irma Aguirre from Nevada. You are in the city, Irma, I believe, indoors, as are many people today because of the freezing temperatures. The inauguration has moved indoors and so have many of Donald Trump's supporters. You are one. I believe you're at a private watching party. How are you feeling today?
Well, I'm feeling very, very excited, along with the thousands of Trump supporters that have descended here into Washington, D.C. The city is incredibly jubilant, and we're feeling great.
Why are you a Trump supporter?
You know, I have been a Trump supporter from day one. I just felt that a man that has accomplished as much as he has in terms of what he did in New York, being a successful businessman, was somebody that we needed, that this country needed. I was tired of the, you know, politician type, and we needed somebody that was a doer.
He is a businessman. You are a businesswoman. I've been to your restaurant in Nevada. In Las Vegas. But are you concerned at all? You're also a Latina woman. We're hearing about closing the southern border, could even start happening today. At the biggest deportation operation in history is what he's promising. Is that something you want to see?
What we want to see in the Latino community is common sense, law, and order. We want him to start with the deportations of the thousands that are sitting in federal prisons right now. They're criminals with deportation papers already ready to go. They have been there for years. They should have been deported years ago, and they should be deported today.
So that is your view. And of course, Latina is such a huge vote. It's not a monolith by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm wondering how you find it in the city. This is a Democrat city, true blue, as people say, obviously, with so many Republicans in town. Do you find your interactions over the past few days have been friendly or civil, or is there a divisiveness there?
Not at all. We haven't encountered that at all. It's been very civil. It's been very peaceful. We have the National Guard all throughout the city keeping everybody safe. Everything has been very organized so far as we can see. And it is very different from 2016, where we had the activists, the leftist activists, all throughout the city running amok, spitting on Trump supporters. We don't see that at all today. And I feel a complete shift.
I don't have any evidence of that taking place, but that
no, I
is
do because
your...
I was there.
Irma Aguirre, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the people watching the party today from the indoors. Stay nice and warm. And as I just see, the vice president-elect and the vice president have just met and gone inside. That meeting taking place, one of the events, of course, of this inauguration. Stay with us here on NewsHour.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
You're listening to NewsHour with me, Nuala McGovern, in Washington. Tim Franks is in London. I'm broadcasting today, if you hear a few plates, glasses in the background, from the Hawk and Dove Bar. This is the oldest political bar, bipartisan, in Washington, D.C., and it's open to folks from both sides of the aisle as they begin to stream in. We're just a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol, a beautiful view outside of that iconic dome. But the focus has moved to the White House, of course, and people are just waiting for Mr. Trump to take up residence there again. And the question is, what will this second term look like? It's been asked repeatedly. We may have an answer very soon. Donald Trump has promised to take action immediately on his campaign promises. His transition team have actually been in place since last summer. So today's official transfer of power means that they can begin to enact the changes that they have been so eager to make. Now, one person who is very familiar with the process is Brigham McCown. He is a senior fellow and director of the Initiative on American Energy Security at the Hudson Institute. This is Mr. McCown's second time being part of a Trump transition team, working this time on changes to the Department of Defense and the Department of Transportation. And I got to speak to him and ask him, what does he think is different this time for Mr. Trump?
You know, I think it is a little bit different this time. In 2016, I think, quite frankly, there was a question of whether he was going to win, and a sort of a belief that you needed to put everything into the campaign and worry less about a transition. I think there have been lessons learned since 16. And in this case, the transition team has been working since summer to prepare policies, to look at how the current government is operating. You know, here in the U.S., we don't really have a shadow government, right? We don't have a government in waiting. And so this transition process, which is official, generally kicks in early fall for both party candidates, just in case, because we don't know who's going to win the election. But yeah, I think it's far more organized this type around.
Is there much interaction with the Biden administration to make a transition smooth?
There is. And I think that's maybe unique about the Western democratic system is this peaceful transfer of power. We've been meeting with our counterparts in the Biden administration, both the senior career civil servants, as well as the political appointees that are in government policy positions. And that cooperation across all the agencies has generally gone on quite well.
Some, of course, the minute you say that, will be thinking of January 6th when it came to 2021 after the 2020 election and did not consider that a peaceful transition of power, as Mr. Trump continued without evidence to say that he had won the election and didn't want the election results ratified. I wonder what your thoughts are on that particular incident.
I don't have any. I mean, it's not my place to comment on that. And I wasn't here during that time, so I can't really comment on that.
Let's talk about foreign policy for a moment. You know, it became a famous quote that Mr. Trump had said that he would be able to solve the Ukraine-Russia war within 24 hours. He's taken office. How long do you think it will take for him to become involved and get to some sort of agreement?
I think what's important is not to look at Trump's opening statement. It's an opening round of negotiation. It's meant to amplify that something needs to be done, that all the parties need to come together. But I think there is an understanding, at least with American policymakers, that we can sit down at a table, but unless and until Russia itself is willing to negotiate in good faith, it's a little hard to stop a war when just one side's at the table. But I think he believes that the war has gone on long enough, there's been enough suffering, and that there has to be a solution. Unfortunately, though, again, this is more up to Russia than it is the United States. And more recently, he said he would end the war within 6 months. Again, I think that's an aspirational goal, and hopefully we can achieve that.
But, you know, there's those that say if an agreement is reached, if President Putin gets some of what he's after in the eastern parts of Ukraine, if it's a victory for him in those respects for invading Ukraine, you will have heard, of course, as well, lots of Europe saying, you know, that Mr. Putin in the future would not stop at that if, in fact, he finds victory by such aggressive actions.
Yes, and I think that's clearly a viewpoint that is shared among the senior fellows and myself here at the Hudson Institute. Poor behavior cannot be rewarded. You deal with a bully through strength, not weakness, and you lay on the table what you're going to not allow that individual to do. And I think that's clearly a concern. And, you know, at the broader whole, I think most of Europe was slow to awaken, as was the United States. And we can trace this back to Georgia in 2007 or even earlier from that. And so let me be clear. I think some of the people going into the Trump administration, they're hardliners. They're Cold War warriors. Not only is trust but verify back, but I think a lack of trust is something that they're quite aware of.
But I mean, what could Mr. Trump do really to be the strong man against Mr. Putin in a scenario like that of the war in Ukraine?
Well, I think President Trump has said publicly that if Putin does not negotiate in good faith, if he does not follow through with what he wants, then we'll arm Ukraine to the teeth and actually remove prohibitions on them, actually give them weapons that should have been given both by the United States and other NATO countries years ago. The point is maximum pressure on Putin to make it for him where he understands there needs to be a peaceful solution and one that can be relied upon. And I think there's a big question about whether he can be trusted, quite frankly. I think, you know, folks in the incoming administration are quite aware of that.
Is Donald Trump this time round an insider instead of an outsider, a Washington insider?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think Trump is a DC insider because to some extent he's a skeptic of the institution of governments. He's a disruptor. He often sees that change comes through disruption, through tension, and quite frankly, at times, controversy. But that leads, in his mind, through to a better solution than if we all pretend everything is well and nobody talks about it. So what he does know better this time around and what his appointees will know better this time around is how to leverage government to carry out their policies and plans, something that had mixed success last time. But I think they'll be far more effective right out of the gate this time around.
But people should expect disruption in those first weeks.
Absolutely. I mean, he's talked about issuing upwards of 100 executive orders on day one. So we'll all have to watch and see what happens.
Brigham McCown, a member of Donald Trump's transition team. He's from the Hudson Institute, which is a conservative think tank. And listening to that is U.S. Senator, Democrat Chris Van Hollen from Maryland. Good to have you with us, Senator. Thank you for taking some time out of your morning. I believe you're in the Capitol building right now. How is it?
Yes, I am. It's being prepared for the inaugural ceremony there. It's cold outside, but hopefully it will remain warm inside.
We were just hearing from a member of the transition team there. He says perhaps 100 executive orders from Donald Trump today. Now we're hearing potentially 200, and also that Mr. Trump and his team believes he knows how to leverage government this time. What are the Democrats intending to do on some of the executive orders that we're feeling and hearing may come through in the next 24 hours? For example, kick-starting the biggest deportation operation in history.
Well, let me just say, I'm very concerned for the future of the country and, in fact, the future of others around the world as we approach this inauguration. I am a strong supporter in effective border security. And yes, as a previous caller said, when you're talking about people who have committed, you know, violent offenses and been convicted of violent crimes, they need to be deported. But we should not be complicit in mass deportations and family separation. The other great concern I heard from your previous speaker was this term leverage the instruments of the government for certain purposes, mm-hmm. because one of the Trump plans is to replace a merit-based civil service. So people who are selected based on their experience and expertise, to replace them with political cronies, that would be a great disservice to the American people.
And I think what the Trump administration would say is that they feel there is such inefficiencies in the federal government. They've talked about having to root out employees that they feel are not doing a good job. I do just want to let our listeners know I am seeing a briefing that was with reporters. This is in relation to immigration, that incoming White House, Trump White House officials have said that Mr. Trump will ask the Attorney General to seek the death penalty for undocumented migrants who kill police officers or commit capital crimes while in the United States. That would be a change from the Biden administration and their policies. But let me ask you about Mr. Biden this morning, taking a moment. He was still the U.S. president. He has issued preemptive pardons for several figures threatened with criminal prosecutions. That is the quote. That includes Dr. Anthony Fauci, who, of course, was instrumental in the COVID-19 response, and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for Mr. Trump, Mark Milley. In the statement, the White House says the pardons are for officers that testified also at the House Select Committee, as well as committee members and staff that investigated the 6th of January 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. Some have thought that Mr. Biden should not do that, that it it sets a precedent that any other president can try these preemptive pardons. What is your reaction?
Well, I hate the fact that we've come to this point, but we've come to this point because Donald Trump has been very open about the fact that he would weaponize the Department of Justice. I mean, you spoke earlier about January 6th, 4 years ago, where the president and his allies, you know, his allies stormed the Capitol in a riot to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. We've seen consistently, you know, President Trump say he will use the Justice Department to go after his political enemies. So this was a preemptive move by President Biden. Again, I don't like the fact that we've gotten here, but that's the reality that we face at this particular moment.
It sounds to me like you believe it's inevitable for Mr. Biden to do this.
Well, the president just announced this, so I think it was clear that he wanted to make sure that these individuals were not the subjects, the victims of political persecutions.
And of course, we don't know whether they will accept those preemptive pardons just yet, but that story is one that's developing. Just in my last minute or so, Senator, obviously, very divided politically, this country, no doubt, is the same in the halls of Congress. What is the mood in there as you see it? Is it depressive or disappointed on the side of Democrats, or is it very much coming together, momentous? Just give me a few words that you think would describe what you're feeling, what you're seeing right now.
Well, I think that Democrats have been clear that they would work with the Trump administration when we're advancing common American interest and goals. But we will fight the incoming Trump administration when they seek to turn back the clock and divide the country. And when it comes to the economy, we're going to be fighting to protect working people in the middle class. And we're very worried about another round of Trump tax cuts that benefit the very wealthy. I should point out that while we all support more government efficiency, but not cronyism.
Senator, I have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me. That's Chris Van Hollen, Democratic Senator from Maryland. I'm Nuala McGovern in D.C. Tim Franks is in London.
You're with NewsHour. It's coming to you live from Nuala McGovern in D.C. and me, Tim Franks, in London. And we're going to head back to the inauguration, the swearing-in of Donald Trump, now just a couple of hours away. We're not going to head back to Nuala McGovern in Washington, though. We're giving her a bit of time to rest her award-winning vocal cords and hear from somebody whose own voice has landed him a big gig today. He's the classically trained tenor Christopher Macchio. And the clue is, well, this is him being filmed on a phone in rehearsal. Fist-pumping yes from Christopher Macchio's manager at a run-through for the national anthem, which he'll be singing at the end of the inauguration ceremony. So, how does that prospect feel?
It's just first and foremost a privilege to have been asked to perform at an event like this at a particularly historic moment. I think that rather than being nervous per se, I just feel imbued with a sense of responsibility to deliver a performance that really honors our great nation, but also uses the universality of music to really try and unite the nation going forward for the next 4 years.
Yeah, you've said in the past, I mean, how you are a firm believer in the unifying power of music. And obviously music can
Yes.
bring people together in an incredibly deep way. You'll also be aware that, you know, one of the biggest cliches about America at the moment is that it is a country divided. I mean, so I guess my question is, really? I mean, do you really think performing the national anthem at the end of the inauguration ceremony can bring the country together?
Well, no one occurrence or one particular contributor, I think, can quite get that job done completely. But it's my humble hope to contribute to other efforts underway that hopefully collectively can achieve that noble goal and move us together in that right direction.
You're singing the national anthem. You're a musician. I wonder sort of, in a sense, how much of a challenge it is, because obviously you want to make it your performance, give it your twist, like, as you would with any other piece of music, but it's not any other piece of music, it's the national anthem. I mean, right. How much license do you think you have?
The way I look at it, first of all, my cultural and artistic tastes tend towards the conservative. From an aesthetic standpoint, especially with something like the national anthem, I will be delivering and believe it's appropriate to deliver a performance that really is in keeping with the way the music was originally written. But within those boundaries, I think there is still room to imbue the performance with some passion, a sense of the nobility of the occasion, the transfer of power, and our collective love of country. And I think that I happen to be very fortunate. I have some power in my voice, some color. And so I'll be endeavoring to use those assets to full effect to deliver the most impactful, stirring, and moving performance that I can within the boundaries of taste and respect for the anthem and the country.
Right. So you're not going to go the full Nessun Dorma, because what I've been reading is that that was the aria, the famous Puccini aria that Donald Trump first noted as one of your sort of killer arias.
Yes.
And that's got very, very long top notes, but you're not going to be doing that for the national anthem then.
Well, to be honest with you, there are two high notes in the national anthem, and I will be holding those notes a little longer than maybe the music was written, because those are the two moments that I think people really listen for. They are a bit of a musical climax, and so I will indulge just a little bit on those two notes. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, understood. We'll look forward to that. As far as Donald Trump is concerned, you would agree, Christopher, you're in a bit of a minority in the artistic community, because I know you're a massive believer in the man.
Absolutely.
You're incredibly enthusiastic about who he is, what he stands for. And I mean, you will be aware that a lot of artists in all sorts of fields, but music is certainly one of them, they are not fans of the man.
No, they're not. There obviously is a tendency in the artistic community towards a liberal sensibility in recent years, maybe even a more overtly leftist progressive sensibility. And for myself, I just have always, my entire life from childhood, was precociously politically aware, and I always had very conservative values at my core. And so really, President Trump has been the first president in my lifetime that has consistently adhered to those standards. I support him wholeheartedly without necessarily feeling the need to throw it in everybody's face at every opportunity in an obnoxious way. It's everybody knows precisely where I stand on President Trump, that I'm 1,000% loyal, unconditionally so. But at the same time, I think there's a way to go about expressing your support that is mindful of and respectful of, you know, where other people are coming from, because that gives you the room and the flexibility to hear what their concerns might be, and then polemically to maybe address some of those concerns and change some hearts and minds. And really, that's something that in my private life and also in my professional life, I endeavor to accomplish.
And what about Donald Trump? I mean, do you think that you might be able to persuade him to sit through an entire opera?
Well, you know, I really don't know if he's ever done that. I know he loves opera. So as far as sitting through an entire one, I think the breadth and gravitas of his responsibilities might make that a little bit difficult, at least over the next 4 years. But I do know that opera is featured prominently on his playlist. So I'll do my best to give him the best operatic experience possible whenever I see him.
Christopher Macchio, who will be singing the national anthem at the end of the inauguration ceremony. We've got full coverage of that, of course, here on the BBC World Service with Nuala McGovern in DC in just over an hour. And then the second Donald Trump term of office will begin, and The promise of a very new America, at least as far as he's concerned, perhaps a changed world, will be there all the way to watch and work out what's going on, what it means and why. It's going to be a busy few years. From Nuala McGovern in Washington and me, Tim Franks in London, thanks very much for your company.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.